This is episode number 4 with Michael Fogg. Welcome to the I Love Music podcast. My name is Jen Fedor. I started the I Love Music podcast to inspire people who love music, encourage people who work within the industry, and to hear each person's unique story. For episode number 4, I got to interview my friend Michael Farr and had the pleasure to work with him on the Vans Warped Tour. Michael has worked for so many artists. I don't even know where to begin. Tom Petty, Jack White, David Bowie. He's gotten to work with legends. But most importantly, he has a huge heart for people within the industry struggling with addiction. He's a sober coach for Music Cares. I hope you enjoy hearing his insightful, fun, and encouraging stories. Here is Michael Farr.
Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
So what is your best childhood or teenage memory about music?
I was thinking about that because there's many.
Yeah.
But I would have to say my second concert ever. And it you know, there's a lot of moments as a child where you just get grabbed by music. I remember when I heard AC/DC for the first time, I was sitting on the beach. I was like, who is this band? Mm-hmm. This is the raddest shit, you know. Yeah. Can I cuss on your podcast?
Oh, yeah,
okay,
of course.
Sorry.
Yeah, oh, I don't know. Yeah, you can. Totally, 100%.
I'm kind of a sailor mouth.
Yeah, of course, 110%, yeah.
That's fucking great. But I think probably I went to my second concert. I was like 14 years old, I think.
Who was it?
It was called the California Jam, and it was a whole bunch of bands. It was just, first kind of festival that was California Festival called the Cal Jam. And it was Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Wow.
Black Oak, Arkansas. It was like this whole Rare Earth, Earth, Wind and Fire. It was crazy. It was the craziest lineup. I think Seals and Cross played. It was just insane. And I just remember going there and I was this bright-eyed kid and I couldn't believe, like, trash cans got set on fire. I remember like in the middle of the night, it was just like crazy, and I had to pee really bad, and I went behind this like little wall and I'm peeing, and there's these like people having sex and I'm peeing on them, you know, and they're like, hey, what the fuck? And I was just like, sorry, I didn't know you were there. And it was just like the craziest scene where it was super apocalyptic in a way. But the favorite memory was somewhere along the line, a water bottle fight had broken out, and we're talking thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people, and everybody had these gallon jugs of water, and all of a sudden, during Deep Purple, it just got airborne, and I swear it was like a bombing raid. There were these giant jugs flying through the air with water streaming out the back of them, and you'd just be like, incoming, you know, and you'd jump so you didn't get hit in the head with one of these things, And it was so crazy that Deep Purple actually stopped playing, and they were like, listen, you know, Ritchie Blackmore was like, we're not going to, you guys fucking stop it, you know, or we're not going to play anymore. This is insane. You guys are going crazy. And it was like, I just looked up in the air and there was, it seemed like thousands and thousands of water bottles being thrown. Wow. It was so insane.
Yeah.
And I was a kid. I mean, you know, I remember some guy walking up to me and like, hey, dude, I like your glasses. Can I try them on? And I had these sunglasses on and he stole them. And I was just like, what the fuck just happened? You know, and it was it was absolutely crazy. But it was that kind of craziness and weird freedom that just made me love, you know, that scene. It was dangerous and it was energetic and it was alive and the bands were cool, and I don't know, you know, I think that was, as a childhood memory in music, that sort of set a tone for me, you know. That probably was the one, you know.
So pretty much from that moment, did that, like, were you set on, oh, I want to work in the music industry, or I want to, you know, be in a band, or what was your, kind of your story leading up?
Yeah, the trajectory.
Yeah,
of,
yes,
of,
yeah.
Well, so music had become my master, you know. I, you know, for whatever reason, maybe it was because I grew up at the beach or in California or in LA. I mean, there's a vibrant music scene here. You know, my parents were exposed me to music, even though it wasn't my thing. They were listening to a lot of like Sergio Mendez and the Tijuana Brass and Burt Bacharach and stuff, which is really rad music. You know, I mean, it's musical, you know, Neil Diamond and, and I would hear that and I would kind of appreciate it. And my father was into jazz, like, you know, serious jazz, Coltrane jazz and stuff like that, which took me a minute to get a flavor for, but I ended up really into jazz as well. But yeah, the whole thing, it didn't really matter to me what style, you know. When I first heard like the rockabilly stuff, Elvis and Scotty Moore playing guitar and Duane Eddy and all those guys, I loved the twangy stuff like that. I also really liked punk rock, and I came from a rock and roll background. I went to Zeppelin and, you know, all those great bands, Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and, you know, the big great bands, you know, the Stones and all that stuff. And, you know, so there was so much there. I mean, even bands like the Stones started off like really playing a lot of American rockabilly music, same with the Beatles. And then they morphed into something completely different eventually, you know, more of their own thing, but it was still based and steeped in that kind of guitar driven music, you know. So just like those bands, I think it's an evolution, you know. I evolved into loving, you know, I really like the rhythm and blues guitar players, you know. I loved Johnny Winter and, you know, listening to, you know, the really great blues guitar players, you know, Lightning Hopkins and all those cats. So there wasn't really a kind of music.
Right.
It was just music, you know, all kinds of music. And certain genres would come by me. And, you know, I was really fortunate. I mean, I grew up in the Ziggy Stardust days and T-Rex and all that. You know, I saw all those bands play, you know, and UFO and, you know, just the whole, it was amazing. I saw Queen at a small club, you know.
Oh,
it was
freaking
insane.
That would have been amazing.
And they were touring their second album, and it was just remarkable to just watch the show they did. Side one of their album was a white side, and so they came out dressed all in white, and then they did side black, which was the second side of the album, and they changed and did all, you know, dressed all black. It was just cool, the theatrics, you know, not just the music, but how they played the music live and performed it. Theatrically, I think it was really just, it just caught me, you know. And I really found that it was super artistic between music and theatrics. You know, it really gave it its own voice. And I really think that was what got me, you know.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, being able to grow up in LA and go to smaller concerts, it's just...
Yeah, we had it all here. And I mean, I'm 58 years old, so I really got lucky growing up in the age of music that I got to grow up into, because, you know, there was some really amazing bands, and so many bands were so good that you had to be good to be a band, you know. Mm-hmm. You couldn't just line up against Zeppelin and go, oh, well, I can be just a shitty band. No, you can't, you know. You know, like ZZ Top, great band, you know. You couldn't be just a shitty band, you know. I mean, you know, they turned into something funny, but initially, if you listen to some of those first ZZ Top records, they're amazing, you know, like great guitar work.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah.
Hendrix, you know, I grew up, Janis Joplin, all that stuff, you know, Neil Young. I mean, the some of the greatest songwriters in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And so those were like my summer songs, you know. We'd get summer vacation on the beach was like, I remember Heart of Gold record came out, Neil Young. That was the summer of 72, you know, whatever, you know, 74, whenever that record came out. Mm-hmm. But it was like, you remember your time of life with the music that kind of accompanied it. It's a soundtrack, you know, and that's really cool, you know.
Definitely. Did you get to ever meet any of them, like Janis or like?
Never Janis or Jimmy. I met Stevie Ray Vaughan just before he passed away, which was a wild experience because he was sober. He had been sober for a while. I was not. I was actually really a drunken mess, but he was super cool.
Yeah.
And we talked about recovery. I was curious about his recovery, and he was the sweetest dude in the world, man. He really was the kind of guy that made you feel better after meeting him, you know. You just felt better as a person. It was it was cool. But yeah, I've been friends with you know, Billy Gibbons and of ZZ and you know, hanging out and meeting Brian Setzer and all those guys and being their photographer for a little bit. Just, I mean, I've had some amazing moments, you know, hanging out with Angus and you know, it's like it's super weird, you know, how life is. I mean, I don't think that I could be a Uber fan and have pulled that off. I think that I had to get through that and just start to realize. And I think that happens when you work in music, is that you start to realize that these people, it's really important to give them their space. You know, I mean, yes, they chose to be public figures, but also I think they really recognize and appreciate people who don't, you know, want to get a selfie with them. And, you know, like not everybody has to be pretend that they're their best friend. And, you know, that's important. And so I think I had to kind of outgrow fandom first before I could actually get into just actually working in the industry and like actually hanging out with these people.
Yeah.
You know, which is cool because, you know, I mean, I've got some great friends that are really famous people and they're really cool people. And I think that they appreciate that I don't really care about being their friend. You know, I mean, I like being their friend, but I don't have to.
Right. You know? Exactly.
You know, I can also just do my job and and hang out. So,
But
yeah, I got to meet, I got to meet many, many of my guitar heroes and music heroes. And sometimes it works in the opposite way. Sometimes you meet some of these people and you don't like them and it bums you out because then it ruins the music. It's like, oh wow, that guy's an asshole, or that person's you know, shitty, but that's life, you know. So
I do want to get into like your sober story at some point, but were you any bands like growing up? Because you were a musician.
I played in a bunch of what I call cowpunk bands. They're sort of like country flavored twangy punk rock, three chord twangy aggressive rock and roll bands. Never anything noteworthy, but super fun. Super fun to be in, and you know, really able to appreciate, you know, you can talk about guitar playing all day long. You can watch a guitar player play guitar and appreciate it all day long, but you can't really understand guitar playing unless you get up and play it, you know? And it's like anything. You can talk about meditation all day long, but unless you meditate, you just not, you don't know of it, you know? You can't talk about drinking water and then be hydrated. You have to actually drink water. So the same is, I think it was really wonderful to be in an operating band, because you realize that it's a marriage between a bunch of people. It's difficult, as all marriages can be. It's super ego driven, you know, everybody has their ideas, and then it's super intense to just, you know, get over the fear of playing in front of people and have a good time, and then kind of notice there's like this progression. You get better at it, you know, and it's really cool, and you stop making the mistakes and you start doing it on automatic pilot. And like, I, one of the things, I was a singer and guitar player, and I couldn't believe that I could remember lyrics to so many songs. Like, it seems dumb, but we had hundreds of songs in our catalog, and it was phenomenal because I can't remember shit. I can't remember a lot, you know, and yet I was able to assimilate lyrics, you know, and you know, it would be just the most automatic thing to just spill out whatever it was that we were playing. It was really cool.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, we did. We were like mostly a cover band, but we would fuck stuff up. We would always ask ourselves, okay, what would Aerosmith sound like if Motorhead did it? And then we would do Aerosmith song in a Motorhead tuning, you know. And they were so much fun. You know, what would Johnny Cash sound like if the Ramones did it? You know, and then we would do that. And it was so much fun. People really enjoyed it. We were a great opening band, you know, for whoever else. We got the crowd good and drunk. And and then, you know, then the headliner could come on, or the opening, or the, you know, the band that actually was a band. But Yeah, just actually recognizing what goes into performing and playing and stuff was great. And, you know, playing music's really magical, man. When you got a bunch of dudes or a bunch of people, men and women, whatever your band consists of, you know, cohesively putting together a great song, it's pretty amazing. It's super spiritual and cool, you know.
Do you have any memorable moments from the road from during that time?
Well, we weren't really a road band. I mean, we were just like a bar band. We played a lot of shitty bars, but in California.
Okay.
I mean, we played some good places too. We actually played the Derby in Hollywood and stuff, but no real road moments from that band experience because we didn't travel on the road.
Okay.
But I used to be a tour manager for a bunch of punk rock bands, and I remember this one band, Los Infernos. They were really great, kind of a cowpunk band out of Riverside, super, super rad band. And I remember seeing one of the guys in the band at another show, I don't know, a few years ago, and he was like, dude, I can't believe, he was telling his friend, he goes, this guy used to be our tour manager, and homeboy would always carry a fucking gun with him. And I'd forgotten about that. Like, he was like, yeah, he always had a 45. And I'm like, that's right, I did that shit. I used to, like, we used to travel the road, and we would stop in the desert and shoot my gun, you know. And, and I didn't realize how insane that was, but but it was like, hey, we're out in the middle of the desert, you know. Uh-huh. Like, I'm not going to drive to Texas without a firearm, you know. Like, who knows what's going to happen? But I guess that doesn't go over too well in today's climate. But but back then it was the thing, you know.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, it was.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it's funny.
So what was one of your first jobs in the music industry?
My first gig in the music industry was literally stage. So I think it was a Bowie show, and Bowie and the Police were playing. It was Anaheim Stadium. And I want to say it's the Glass Spiders tour, but I've since Googled that, and I don't think it was. It was a different tour, I think. But it's just so weird. I mean, I know I did it. I was there, but I can't really figure it out on Google. Anyway, memory doesn't serve me that well. But it was a Bowie and Police show, and the thing was so huge that the union guys that built the stage wouldn't tear it down. And the Rams, and the Rams were playing at noon the next day, so. Like, we were really up against it. So we got called in. We called ourselves the Spider Monkeys. And at that time, stages were built out of scaffolding.
Okay.
And so you'd have to climb up scaffolding, you know, and then unscrew a piece of scaffolding and then hand it down to the guy beneath you in like a, you know, like like literally just sort of a chain gang, but it was a vertical chain gang. And it was hairball because, you know, we got there and then they were like, okay, you know, you can watch the show if you want, but you're going to have to start when the show is over.
Okay.
And so, of course, you know, we're 20 years old or whatever, and we're like, fuck, we're watching the show, and everybody's doing blow, and everybody's like fucking wasted. And it was funny because all my life I had had people say, you look just like that singer guy. And I'm like, I know, David Bowie. And for some reason I would, to a lot of people, I mean, hundreds of people have said that in my lifetime. So that night, one of Bowie's crew guys said the same thing. He goes, dude, he goes, I can't believe it. You look just like, and I'm like, I know. And he goes, do you want to meet him? And I said, fuck yeah, I want to meet him. And so he brought me backstage to meet Bowie in between an encore. And it was really a cool, weird moment because he explained to David why I was there. David looks at me and he says, oh, well, that's quite flattering. He's very handsome. And then I had that moment of like, did I just get recruited? Like, you know, like did the bands go get the girls out of the audience? Like, I'm like, did they just recruit me to like, and I was like, that's fucking weird. Cause I love Bowie, but I'm not gay. So that didn't work for me, you know? And I had this like weird, awkward moment. Like, why am I here? Anyway, whatever, but it was funny. And that's like literally the first time I've ever worked in the music industry. I meet David Bowie, which was rad. And then we had to like just tear the stage down. I to this day, I don't think I've ever been as sore in my life as after that gig. I mean,
wow.
We were
so you were building the stage.
And well, we had to take it down. So we had to be prepped and ready for this thing to when the show was over at whatever midnight, we started working, and we had from that time till noon. So we had to get this giant production off the field so that the Rams could play football.
Oh my gosh.
And I mean, that means every single piece of everything, the trucks have to be loaded and gone so that the Rams can play.
Uh-huh.
And it was freaking hairball. I mean, you know, we were up all night, we're watching the show, we're, you know, you know, it wasn't coffee, it was blow at that time. So, and we're like young, you know, so it's kind of like you're invincible, but you're not really.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's getting hit in the head with scaffolding and bleeding, and our hands are brutalized. And it was fucking incredible, man. But yeah, that was like the first gig. And again, it was so wild that, and it was just such a pirate feeling, like a pirate ship, you know, because.
To work for
Bowie. You know, and then just have this whole like, you guys are the guys that are going to make this happen because, you know, the union guys won't do it. It's just too gnarly for them. And we're like, that's awesome, you know, because we'll fucking do it, you know.
Right.
And it was gnarly.
How did you get connected? Do you remember?
Some guy that I knew. I don't really, he worked in staging and he was up against it. And he said, I'm hiring a crew. And we were, you know, smoking weed or whatever together, whatever we were doing. And I just said, yeah, I'll try it, you know. And he was like, it's Bowie. And I'm like, oh, for sure. You know, can I see the show? And he's like, yeah, if you want to, you know. And so I was like, yeah, I want to. So it was cool, you know. But it was also a punisher. But again, it's kind of like, you know, you get a taste of that life and, you know, and when you're young and you're just like, wow, I'm just so lined up and the stars are all aligned and you get to meet David Bowie and, you know, even though it's like, you know, you get this delayed reality of like, why am I actually here? And then it's like, it doesn't matter. I just met Bowie and it's just like, but I hope, you know, whatever. But I hope he's not hitting on me because that would be awkward. But, you know, it's just funny, you know, how all that stuff plays out. But when you're young, you know, that also sets a tone. It's kind of like, you know, the water bottle fight at the California Jam. It's just like, what the fuck? This is so crazy and wild, you know, like Deep Purple's yelling at the audience to stop fucking around, you know, Bowie's like saying, wow, you know, like, nice to meet you. You're super handsome. You know, it's just, I don't know, you know, not many people get to do that. And and, you know, it's just one of those things where it makes an impression on you and you want that to happen again. You know, you're like, wow, that was awesome. And so if somebody says you want to work again, you're like, yeah, you know, and it might not happen again for a while, but, you know, that kind of stuff might not happen or it might, but, you know, again,
you take the opportunity.
I mean, and you get to be around, you know, the music that you love, you know, so it's kind of remarkable, really.
You know?
I mean, I'm super jaded as I'm saying all this. I have to remind myself that, you know, it's nice that you remind me that, you know, there was a spark there that was just so wild and wide-eyed and wonderful, you know, and just like anything, you know, you kind of, once you've done it a while, you know, it's hard to remember the spark, you know?
What has been one of the most challenging moments working in the music industry for you?
It's challenging when the inner workings of the music industry is this, like, you know, it's like this mythical place, right? Backstage, it's a mythical environment. You know, you're like, what happens back there? You're a fan and all you can see is the stage and you're like, but what goes on back there, you know? And you know, and you spend a lot of time just, you know, thinking, wow, if I could only, you know, step into that environment, you know? And then once you do, you start to realize that, you know, there's the Wizard of Oz effect, you know, that there's, you know, it's not the Grand Wizard, man. It's like, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of people humping and there's a lot of really amazing human beings making this thing work.
Yeah.
You know, and it's difficult to see those unsung heroes stay unsung, you know. And it's difficult to see music just for money, You know, the music to me is the voice of the people. And when it becomes monetized, it seems to change it a lot.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a business model. And, you know, you get backstage and you get to know the business aspect of it and the production aspect of it. And you realize that this is a machine just like any other machine, any other business. And more and more, as I've grown older, it's become more corporatized. And now it's not as fun, man. You know, it's like, you know, it used to be about the people. It used to be about anarchy. It used to be. And it's funny to see these bands that used to sing about the people. And the people can't even get a seat, you know, they can't even afford a fucking seat, you know, and, I work for some really big festivals, as you know, and, you know, there's that thing, man, you know, it's like super grateful to have a job. I'm super thankful that, you know, I've got the experience of life that I have. I'm not at all confused how lucky I am. But I'm also aware and awake to, you know, the shit that we were screaming about in the 80s and in the, you know, 60s and the 70s. It was real, you know.
Yeah.
There's still a corporate entity that is just about money. And money is not inherently problematic, but the love of it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, the more successful some things get in the music industry, the less money gets spread around to the right people, you know? And so the little guys that really, really, really hump, you know, backstage, they don't get recognized, you know? And it's that's hard for me. That's a hard thing to swallow because, you know, one of the reasons I put these bands and musicians and music on a pedestal was because it seemed authentic and pure to the people.
Yeah.
And once it starts to get sold, it changes it, man.
It does.
You know?
Yeah.
The lyrics are the same, but the the vibe is different. The voice is different.
Yeah.
You know? And when there's $400 million involved, it's like, it's $400 million or $4 million or whatever million, you know?
Yeah.
Millions of dollars involved, it changes shit real fast.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, if millions of dollars that were involved got spread out to everybody, it would be one thing. But it doesn't.
It
doesn't.
It doesn't.
And I see the artists actually selling their souls too a little bit, which is also counterintuitive to the music that they write, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I don't know what the answer is. I mean, it's just money. It's just finance, you know, and we live in a world that's just, it's extremely difficult to survive without it. You know, you just can't.
Yeah.
So you've got, again, it goes back to the political bullshit and the haves and have-nots and how the fuck are we going to equalize this planet, you know, and make it all work. And, you know, that's a whole different conversation. But, it's politics has always been part of music, too, you know. I mean, we've always been screaming about, you know, wars and strife and famine and, you know, homelessness and people suffering and stuff. And yet at the same time, you know, that shit gets ignored pretty quickly, you know? I mean,
are there any bands now or artists that you're like, oh, like, you see the pure message coming across?
Yeah, well, see, I do. I mean, I think I have to be careful of my own lenses that I look out of. But, I mean, I think that there's still pure messages out there. I think that the bands still believe in their messages. I just think it's harder for the bands. You know, you see, like, the festival thing now, it's just, everything's kind of geared to big, you know? And when, you know, bigger is better, then intimacy gets lost. And then it doesn't matter, you know, if I keep going back to Neil Young for some reason, but, you know, if Neil Young's singing Heart of Gold to, you know, 100,000 people, it's a lot different than, you know, singing it at McCabe's for 25, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I always enjoy smaller
crowds. Yeah, you know, and those things have become a thing of the past. And, I mean, even I know that, last year the Stones played the Echo, and, like, nobody fucking could go see that except the insiders, you know, and yeah. and it's like, I get it, but also
I tried to get tickets.
Yeah.
I was so, yeah. I kept like refreshing online.
Yeah.
I was like, oh.
Yeah. I mean, like, it just would have been a hell of a show to see. And, right. You know, it's just too bad that it doesn't get rolled out. It's too bad, I think, that that just isn't a thing yet. You know, I really thought for a minute we would start seeing a lot of these bands start doing that. You know, I know some bands do. But I thought we would start to see more of it. But then the festival thing kind of became huge. And that's the other thing, is just seeing it sort of all look the same, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of the same, the usual suspects. It's like, oh, you know, here's this festival, or here's that festival, or here's another festival, and it's all the same usual suspects. It's yeah. like, oh, same it's Radiohead. Yeah. It's, oh, you know, Radiohead's a fucking rad band, and they write rad music, and they're about rad shit. But it's like, oh, so really, we got Radiohead again, and, you know, Arcade Fire, and, you know, Jack White, and, you know, yeah. you can just name them, you know, and it's like, yeah. I love all the bands I just mentioned, like, love them, especially Jack, you know?
Yeah.
And I think he's a Puritan, you know. I think he really has a voice for rock and roll and for music, you know. Like, that dude, when he built that guitar out of fucking wood and yeah. shit, you know, like, it's yeah. so amazing. Yeah. He's such an awesome, I wish I had in one finger the rock and roll that guy has. But, you know, I think that probably, I haven't talked to him. I've worked for him, but I haven't talked to him. But he probably has the same struggle as an artist, you know, as, mm-hmm. you know. How does this stop being such a business and more back to art?
You right, know? Yeah.
And that's also interesting with the recovery thing, because I think a lot of people, I don't know if you saw Amy, the movie, but, you know.
I haven't yet.
The business model kills people that have problems.
Yeah.
And
Tell me a little bit about your story and how you got sober.
I grew up with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And not necessarily in any order.
Yeah.
But it really was kind of pitched that way, you know? And there was an anti-establishment vibe to that, and there was a freedom feeling to that, and there was like a fuck the man kind of a thing to that. And then in reality, all it really was just, you know, we got slammed right with the war on drugs, which became a war against the people.
Yeah.
There was no war on drugs. There's no, you know... There's no war on drugs, you know, like there's absolutely, the war is against people who are using drugs and buying drugs. And mm-hmm. So I got sober because I didn't have any other option. I mean, I had, you know, flash forward into my 30s, I'd gotten sober for a brief moment. And, you know, I was going to jail a lot. I was having a lot of problems behind drugs and alcohol. And, not to get...
Were you just like, caught up in the music scene with, like, the magical, like...
Yeah, it started that way. It started yeah. that way. But then, you know, there are people who do drugs and there are drug addicts, you know? Mm-hmm. And they're different. You know, I don't really think it's normal for anybody to do cocaine, really, if you really think about it.
Yeah,
it's like not normal for the average housewife to sit down and do a big line of coke, but
yeah,
but you know, we, especially in Los Angeles and in Hollywood, it seems to be normalized, but I don't think overall that's a normal behavior. So I say it with a little reverence, because I don't know why. I always wonder why the world wants to be, it can't be sober. I don't know why it's so important for the world to be so fucked up all the time. It really shows me that nobody yeah. wants to be awake to what's going on. Personal opinion is mm-hmm. that I don't think people are at all awake. I think, you know, right. it's part of the sleepiness of humanity that we're all, everybody, you know, it can't wait till Friday night to get obliviated, you know, yeah. to get out of their yeah. themselves. You know, to forget whatever it is that, you know,
any
is bothering
emotion,
them. Yeah.
Emotion
yeah. They don't want to feel anything. And we have this addiction in Buddhism. You know, it talks about, the Buddha was really clear about our addiction to and our craving for feeling good mm-hmm. and our, you know, resistance to feeling bad. And in the Buddha's perspective, he was like, that's the cause and the root of all suffering and all problems on the world, in the world, you know, is that at some point that addiction to feeling comfort will be the thing that motivates you to step on your neighbor's neck to get ahead, you know. And also the resistance to feeling bad will be the same thing that motivates you to fuck other people over if you're not mindful.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so everybody's just, you know, and when I say everybody, it's, I'm obviously coming through my own lenses, but a lot of the people that I'm around cannot, the idea of sobriety is just frightening. And I understand why, because I'm sober, you know?
Yeah.
I got sober because I had had a taste of it and I relapsed and I ended up in prison. And I ended up overdosing before that, and I was in a coma for 2 weeks, and I was really just going to die. And I had a magic moment where my illegal activities caused an arrest, and I had a SWAT team like kick my door in and take me away, and that was a blessing in disguise. And so I got to sit in a jail cell and kick a heroin habit and really ask myself some serious, like, upfront questions. Which was, you know, why is it, like, I heard myself telling my cellie one day how good my life was outside, like how rad traveling and working in the music industry. And then as I laid down that night, I thought, man, I'm so full of shit. You know, like, how good could life be if I'm still in prison, right? I'm in prison again.
Yeah.
Yet I'm telling this guy how great my life is. Like, I'm an idiot, you know? And I thought, well, what is that disconnect? Like, what is that going on inside of me? So when I got out, I stayed sober. I'd stay sober in prison. I stayed sober when I got out. I met some people that work in the music industry through Music Cares.
Yeah.
And I was literally standing in a donut shop in Ventura wearing another inmate's clothing who went to prison because I got arrested in my underwear. And so they released me in clothes, you know, somebody else's clothes that didn't fit.
Yeah.
And I went to this donut shop, and the guy was very used to having convicts who had just gotten released come over. And he said, you know, do you have any money? And I was like, no. And he says, do you need to make a phone call? And I said, yeah. And he goes, do you want a donut? And I said, yeah. Coolest guy. And I called Harold Owens at Music Cares, and I said, hey, dude, I heard that you could, you might be able to help me, you know? And he said, well, what's your situation? And this guy I talked to on the phone before. And a sweet guy, and I really recognized how kind and loving he is and was to me and didn't judge me, you know. And so I don't know, something about his voice, I wanted something that he had. And he said, well, can you get to LA? He asked me where I was. I said, Ventura. He says, can you get to LA? I said, I'll try, you know, I'll walk, you know. And he goes, can you go to a meeting? And I said, sure, AA meeting. And so he goes, after the meeting, call me. And I think he just wanted to know I was willing enough to, like, do that.
Yeah.
And so I did. My brother came and picked me up. He took me to a meeting. I called Harold. I said, he goes, how are you? And I said, good. I'm at a meeting. And he goes, great. I got you a bed at a sober living house. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome. And they paid for like 9 months or more of you know, sober living for me, to give me space to learn how to just be sober.
Yeah.
And because I was like 48 at the time.
Okay.
Because I'd been loaded my whole life. You know, I mean, I'd literally taken that drug train through every experience of my life. So I didn't really have any experiences that were sober. I didn't know what a sober experience actually looked like. I didn't know what having sex sober felt like. I didn't know what, you know, going to the DMV sober. I didn't know about grocery store. I didn't know anything. Yeah. You know, like, it was always, you know, smoked out or fucked up on something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it gave me the ability to just, you know, be okay because I was disconnected, right?
Yeah.
And that was important for me to understand that what was it that was driving me to drink. And you know, over a period of time, I realized that, you know, I had created a self-corrosive story that I was no good and that I was unlovable and unlikable. I didn't know any of that shit was really happening in my subconscious, you know.
Right.
But through working the program and doing step work and the kind and loving hands of, you know, the program, like the men in the program put their arms around me and basically loved me until I could learn to love myself,
you know.
And then through self-care and self-love, I realized that the world isn't a hostile environment, that my parents aren't responsible for my drug use, that they were just doing the best that they knew how, and it wasn't personal. And yeah. Hey, guess what? Life isn't personal. You know, it's like, it seems so dumb and simple, but it's, you know, my alcoholism looked like that before I drank. I felt like it always had to do with me, you know, like yeah. Everything that had to do with me. Like my dad, of course, left my mother because I was no good. And it's like, no, actually they were having problems, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But as a kid, I didn't realize that. I don't know. You know, I just right. was wired it that way, you know? Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, like if I dropped a baseball or a girl didn't want to be my friend or whatever, it was evidence that in fact, see, I know, I knew it, I'm no good, right? And that evidence became harder and harder to live with. And then I just started drinking, you know?
Yeah.
And I really have found that a lot of people who drink and use drugs excessively feel the same way. They just don't want, they don't know it or they can't admit it, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel really lucky to have not died at the hands of my own, you know, untrue story, right?
Right, yeah.
And because it's not true, you know? It's just, yeah. All I had to do was make a new story, really. But it yeah. was difficult, you know, to...
I know, there yeah. yeah, tapes.
To rewire, yeah, to rewire, you know, the way that I think. I mean, I still yeah. have it, believe me, I still have it. I'm super sensitive in weird ways, you know, like... You know, somebody doesn't say hello the way I think they should, and I feel like they all of a sudden don't like me, or, you know, it's just, it's weird to feel like that. And yeah. the best medicine for that is just to be honest about it and you know, just put it out in the air and just go, you know, I know this is ridiculous, but it's really how I feel,
right?
You know, and yeah, I'd rather be embarrassed and yeah. tell you how I really feel than fucking kill myself, you know, so
yeah.
Yes. You know, and that led me into working in recovery and music in the music industry, which has been so fulfilling because if nothing else, I can't be helping another human being and hate myself. You know, yeah. it's just, you know
That's
what I mean?
True.
It's
That's,
like really, yeah. it's sort of just, it's kind of like,
true.
You know,
yeah.
I don't really have to worry too much when I'm being of service to other humans, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, that's just a natural act that you can't feel bad about, you know?
Yeah.
I wish that everybody I try to help, you know, takes it, but they don't. I mean, I know that if everybody that got sober stayed sober, we would have meetings at Dodger Stadium, not fucking basements of churches, you know? But,
right.
but it is just the way it is, you know? It's difficult work. To like find out what makes you tick and then address it.
Yeah.
And I think it's heroic that people do it. And at the same time, you know, we don't deserve a medal. I mean, fucking my friend's dog's sober, you know, it's not like that big a deal, but
yeah.
you know, but it is a big deal.
But
you
it
know?
Is.
So it is and it isn't, you know. Yeah. I don't think the world needs to tell us how great we are. But I think it's important that we tell each other how amazing it is because we get it, you know. And mm-hmm. and you know, I wish Amy Winehouse had of had that support around her
yeah.
instead of a bunch of people who relied on her money and the business model to stay running so that they could, you know, have their fun and do their thing.
Right.
And that's fucking sad that she died, and it's sad that Kurt died, and it's sad that Jimmy died, and
yeah.
Janice, and you know. You know, we hear at the 27 Lane Staley. I mean, all these people, man. It's like some of the most amazing, talented people on the planet. And, you know, the business kept them sick.
Yeah.
And it's fucking sad, man.
It you is. Know?
It's really sad.
It totally is.
And I have a heart for that. And I have a heart for those people who suffer at the hands of their own corrosive story, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I really am blessed now to be able to at least, you know, touch people in a positive way, you know. I always thought I would be an example of what not to do. That would be like it. Like, was
yeah.
Mike, how was Mike as an example? Well, that guy was a great example of what a fuckhead looks like, you know. But now it's been a blessing because all that terrible shit turned into a working knowledge of how to be sober and in recovery, you know, be a sober member of the music community.
Yeah.
And be able to live in this world that I wondered, like, will I ever be able to, like, have fun again? You
right.
know, like, will I ever be able to, you know, enjoy music the same way? Will I ever, like, will it ever reach those depths? And and I can tell you, man, I have cried my eyes out at shows where it was just like watching kids fucking go crazy and knowing that we produced it for them and that, you know, this is why we do it, to you know, to make people fucking joyful, you know, and happy. And that's awesome. And I get to work a lot with one-on-one with people in the industry. And it's really cool, you know, to have a community that cares, you know, that just, like, care is an operative word for me, because so many people don't care about anything anymore. They just, it's like, why don't you care? And it's like, they don't even know. They're like, I don't know. It just takes effort to care, and nobody else seems to care. So why should I, right? And it's like, well, I'll tell you why you should care, because if we don't start caring, then the fucking controllers that are ruining this place are going to continue controlling, you know? And we need to care, man.
We need to care. You know, and
Or we're going to have Trump and Hillary running for fucking president, you know? Like, that's insane, you know? So, yeah, we got to start caring, even if it means we go through some hard times. We have to turn our back on that collectively, or it's never going to get better. It's just going to get worse.
So for people that don't know, what is Music Cares and what do they do?
So, let's bring it back to a positive note. Music Cares is an organization. They're the sort of nonprofit loving arm of the Grammys. And what they do is they offer help, financial help in the music community for musicians and crew when they have emergency situations and they don't have money to help themselves. So they cover dental emergencies, medical emergencies. They cover treatment for substance abuse, which is what I work for with them. And they also replace equipment, like the people at Katrina lost a lot of musical instruments, so we replaced a lot for them.
They're an amazing organization.
Yeah, they're a great organization. They saved my life. You know, I mean, obviously I had a lot to do with it, but they gave me the space. They paid for the space for me to save my life, and I swore that I would pay it back, and now I've been able to. And they're just an awesome organization. You know, if you're been working in the music industry for 5 years or more, you have financial assistance from Music Cares, and you know, it is an emergency fund. It's not something that, you know, you, if you have money, don't use it. Wait until, and heaven forbid, you know, like, we don't want you to need it, but if you do need it, it's there for you. We also, I work all year long, or I'm sorry, all summer long on the Warped Tour, the Vans Warped Tour, as the sober ambassador on the tour for the young kids.
That's where I think we originally met there, and then at Fixed Coffee right before.
Right down the street,
down the street.
Yeah, sober and coffee go hand in hand. excuse me, I'm drinking water. Yeah, I mean, and I get to, you know, host meetings, and I do meditation, guided meditations on the road, and you know, we're out there for 8 weeks, and people have all kinds of problems when we're touring, you know, and there's a lot of meltdowns that happen, and you know, people hurt themselves, and I'm the guy that they come to, and they say, hey, listen, I, you know, I just passed a kidney stone, and I don't know what to do with the doctor bill, you know, and I'm like, no problem, we'll take care of it. Or, hey, I realize that I have a drinking problem, and I know that you're the sober guy, can I talk to you? And I'm like, absolutely, thank you for asking, you know. And it's really, when it comes right down to it, as cynical as I am about, like, for instance, politics and stuff, I really love people. And I think that, you know, people don't really, we're not really taught how amazing we really are, you know. We're not told on a regular basis, you're an incredible, it's incredible to be a human being, it's incredible to be alive, and it's incredible to be alive at this time, you know. We're more geared towards, you know, this is what you got to do to make money, and you got to make money because you got to do that to, like, have the life. You know, it's like Carlin said, you know, the American dream's great, but you got to be asleep to believe in it, you know. And and I really, that resonates with me. I actually knew George before he passed away, because he was sober, you know, and very, very smart man. I think that he knew, you know, he was plugged into what was really going on in our planet and in our country. But you know, yeah, Music Cares is just a great organization. They're just a helping organization. It's amazing to be affiliated with them. We do meetings out at Coachella, you know, on show days. We really, really reach out to a lot of people. And it's been phenomenal to be able to help, you know, so many people in my life and kind of give back because, you know, I was so selfish for so long. And you know, I'm able to kind of repay that in my actions now, you know, which is cool.
That's so amazing.
Yeah, it's really rad, you know. Yeah. And it's really, it's a blessing to be, to have this coin, you know, the different sides, like, it's so different from the life that I came from. What I brought into recovery was just fear, and a lot more fear. And now I'm actually, you know, have grown up to be the man, at least close to the man that I thought I always could be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that was just through a lot of, you know, love and kindness of others and also doing the work, you know, just trying to figure out what the fuck is wrong with me and realizing that nothing is wrong with me, that I just think it is, you know, like I'm just a normal dude, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not great and I'm not horrible. I'm just normal. I'm just whatever, you know.
Just going through.
Yeah, like, I'm just living a life through my eyes, which is what everybody's doing, you know, and we're trying to do it the best we can. And
it's true.
I think it's important to help one another, you know, no matter what, you know.
Mm-hmm. So for the bands that are, you know, the baby bands, or any band in general, do you have any words of encouragement for them?
I'm going to paraphrase David Grohl and just say, fucking play music because you love it. Play music because you play music, you know? Be an artist and enjoy being an artist. And play shitty and play horrible until you play better,
you know?
Yeah. And then play better. Yeah. And then get used to playing better and then let it expand. And don't worry about fame and fortune and all that nonsense, man, because that's not why you should play music. You should play music because there's something in your soul and there's something channeling through you, something that you need to, like, let out. And that's what's important, you know. And that's true for any art. Like, that's true for painting. That's true for photography. Obviously, you know I'm a photographer.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I stopped professional photographer world a long time ago because I couldn't reconcile selling or needing to sell it to make a living. Because it just seemed like the people that had more than enough money to pay for it would always jerk me around, and not always, but typically it was difficult to get either what I wanted for it or to even get paid. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, this hurts. It hurts.
Yeah.
So I just started taking pictures because I enjoy it. And, you know, it's been a lot more rewarding to just be a photographer, an unnamed photographer, than maybe trying to be like the biggest best shot guy in the world, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that for any band, you know, be true to the fact that you're an artist and you're a craftsperson, and try to just, I know that there's so much ego involved in it. It's so intense to have people screaming and yelling at you and like everybody's, you've got their attention, but just do it for the art, you know, just do it for the love of doing it, you know.
And why do you love music?
Because it's art, you know? Yeah, because it's art. It's an art form. I mean, music is mathematics. Music is resonance. Music is, you know, vibration. It's everything, really, you know? Everything has a tone. Everything has a vibration. Everything resonates. And that's why there's so much different music, because we all resonate with different vibrations and stuff. So it's pretty amazing, and it's universal. Yeah. You know, it's universal.
It is.
You know, the thing that they don't talk enough about, I mean, we hear about slavery, right? And it's like, if you really research slavery, the most amazing thing about slavery was how the slaves themselves ascended their own slavery and made amazing music and sang and danced and laughed. And like, the slaves were the most amazing example of the human spirit that we've ever had, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you just look at what came out of slavery and you're like, fuck, this is such a great representation of the human spirit, and yet it doesn't get talked about, you know? And you wonder, well, why not, you know? Why don't you want to talk about how amazing the human spirit is? You know, it doesn't matter what color you are. You're a human and you have that spirit and it's a fire that glows inside of you. Music is one way to like let that glow, you know, like light that fire, man. You know,
it is.
To coin a song.
And so what's next for you?
Yeah, I leave in 24 hours to go out to Coachella Valley and to do the Desert Trip show, which is the Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, The Who, and Roger Waters. So basically every band that I grew up listening to, I get to now work for or around.
Yeah.
So they call it Old Cella. I'm fine with that, you know. you know, these are bands that set the tone for every other band that's coming up now. That's another thing. If you're a baby band or if you're a new band, man, really, really, really be thankful and grateful for the bands that turned you into a musician, you know? Because a lot of times we forget that once we start playing or once we start doing our thing. You know, it was because of record covers and these wonderful photographers that I would pour over records and, you know, look at the artwork on these album covers. And I was like, I'm gonna do that someday. I'm gonna photograph rock and roll, you know, I'm gonna photograph music. I'm gonna, you know, and that's what, you know, and I still know the names of all these great photographers. And one of the cool things about Desert Trip is they're having a whole exhibit of all the great photographers that took pictures of all those amazing bands back in the 60s and stuff. So it'll be really cool to see all that work too. Yeah, I'm pretty stoked on that.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's gonna be so great.
It's gonna be neat. Yeah, and just for everybody listening, I love you and I hope that you love yourself and love others.
Thank you so much for doing this interview.
For
today.
Sure, man, for sure. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you again to Mike Farr. And be sure to check out Grammy.org/musichairs for further information about this rad organization. Also, sponsorship is available. Please email me at ilovemusicpodcast@gmail.com if you're interested. Thanks again to Bangups for creating the theme music, Dan Portnoy for the use of his sound equipment. This has been I Love Music with Jen Fedor. See you next time.